This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Hey there, this is Laura Kanoi.
Shh!
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh!
Oh, got it. If you love The Exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for The Exchange. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. It'd be easy to label them the class troublemakers. They don't pay attention, they disrupt the teacher and other students. But these days, instead of just writing off these kids as a problem, many New Hampshire schools are looking more closely at what's behind this behavior. And when they do, they find out that more and more students are coming to class carrying many burdens. Homes where alcohol or drug abuse is present, where parents are neglectful, violent, or even absent. Teachers say more kids than you might think arrive at school with unaddressed physical or mental health issues, or are just really, really hungry. And so some schools have become de facto social service providers, running food pantries, serving breakfast and dinner, providing health care, clothes, even mental health treatment. But even as educators try to fill in these gaps, a larger question waits to be answered. Is this the right role for schools? It's a question NHPR's State of Democracy team has been looking at this week, and today in The Exchange, we'll examine as well this idea of schools as social safety nets. Let's hear from you this hour. Your stories, questions, comments are welcome. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. Casey McDermott is here, NHPR reporter covering politics, policy, and New Hampshire news. You can hear Casey's reports and others on this issue at nhpr.org. And Casey, thank you for taking time out.
Sure thing.
Also with us, Amy Huter, principal of Brown Elementary School in Berlin. And Amy, welcome. Thanks for making the trip to Concord.
Thank you.
And also with us, Michelle Myler, project coordinator of Safe Schools, Healthy Students at the State Department of Education. And Michelle, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Casey, I want to start with you. What jumped out at you from doing all this reporting?
Sure. So I guess just to give a little bit of background, this all started because myself and some others in the newsroom had just been hearing kind of anecdotally from people we've talked to either in the social services world or in the education world that, schools were really having to rethink how they handled mental health in particular for students, and we're having to take on a lot more responsibilities, in that arena. So I tried to kind of start looking into that. And once I started asking around, it became really eye-opening to me that schools were not only just taking on all of these new responsibilities when it comes to students' mental health and behavioral health, but also just, as you said, their basic needs, like making sure that they're fed three meals a day, making sure that maybe if they need to be connected with local homeless shelters, to have clothes to wear, to have shoes that fit them. And really just it was very eye-opening to hear from teachers across the state about the lengths to which they're going out of their way beyond their job descriptions to fulfill just some of the necessities that students need to be able to focus whenever they come into school for the day.
Is there any particular story, Casey, that really just kind of hit you and you went, wow?
Yeah. And this is in the story that's online. But I think one of the ones that resonated most kind of viscerally with me was I was talking to a middle school teacher in Berlin, New Hampshire, who told me that he came into school one day and there was a little girl who told him that she had only had one meal to eat over the weekend. It was a Monday, and she just came in and kind of volunteered that. And that really hit him hard. And that sent that particular teacher kind of scrambling to set up a food pantry right inside the school. And I went up and saw the food pantry. It's a few shelves kind of stocked with, you know, cereal, canned goods, some hygiene items in there in case students need it. And the teacher says it's very discreet. They try to make it so that students don't feel embarrassed by having to go there. But he says that it's been used actually very, very heavily. They've had to restock it quite a bit since it opened earlier this year.
So. Wow. So actually, we have a little clip from the video interview that you did with him, Casey. His name is David Griffin. As you said, he's a teacher at Berlin Middle School. Here he is describing how he was inspired to set up that food pantry.
One young lady who came back on a Monday and told me she had had one meal during the weekend, that kind of struck a nerve. So at the same time, I accidentally came across something on the internet where several schools were coming up with their own food pantry, where they were directly helping the children who were in that building. And so I took that as an inspiration, approached my principal. He thought it was a great idea. We found a place for it to put our little food pantry. And then my wife and I invested a little bit, started it. The idea caught on very, very nicely. There have been food drives here. We've had raffles. And the last couple months, the food pantry has been used an awful lot.
So there's David Griffin, again, part of some of the reporting that Casey McDermott and NHPR State of Democracy team have been doing this week. There he is, Amy, you know, a teacher, his wife, his colleagues. I mean, pulling together to fund a food pantry, digging into their own pockets. How much are you seeing this?
A lot. Teachers are being asked to do a lot, and they have to, in order to meet the basic needs of the students that are coming into our schools nowadays. They don't just have to pass a praxis exam and understand the curriculum. They really need to understand the social and emotional development of the students and make a real relationship with the students and parents to understand what home life is like for these students that are coming into the building every day.
Now, again, you're a teacher at an elementary school, Brown Elementary School in Berlin. What are some of the issues that your kids are coming to school carrying with them?
This year, I actually had a kindergarten student whose mother passed away. And last year, two second graders, their parents had trauma as well. That's just, you know, one of the issues. We have students whose parents are going into rehab. We have homeless students. We have students that are coming to us in foster placements who have gone through trauma. All kinds of different issues that we wouldn't have seen a long time ago. I remember, you know, going through school and the biggest issues that we were dealing with was parents who were getting divorced. And now they are real issues that young kids are having to become resilient.
Are you thinking that this has grown? You're sort of hinting to that, Amy, because I think Rick Ganley asked Casey this earlier this week. I mean, there have always been a couple kids in school who, you know, came in wearing the same clothes and maybe hadn't had a good meal. So this is not to belittle that, but is this really growing or is this just people paying more attention to something that's always been there?
My feeling is that it is growing. Our poverty rates, I think, are increasing. We are over 50% now in Berlin, and that's the most that we have been in that town. So I think the state of economic development has really taken a toll of what we're seeing with basic needs not being met.
What do you make of this, Michelle? Again, I'm so struck by what we heard from David Griffin, you know, holding raffles, digging into his own family budget to set up a food pantry for students.
Schools are needing to shift and broaden what they provide in response to the growing and changing needs, as you've all spoken of today. And schools can't do that alone. You're not in education for any other reason than you really care about kids and development, and you want to be able to support their academic achievement. But along with that comes emotional support and having to support mental health needs in order for them to be successful in all areas of their life and down the road. Schools can't do it alone. Communities have to participate. The state needs to participate. We need to engage as many partners cross-agency as possible to be able to support the schools and the school districts, and down to the level of the teachers who are extending themselves to this extent. So we're happy to be able to support this.
Well, support this role. And I wanted to ask you also, Michelle, you know, you're watching data from the statewide level. What trends are you looking at in particular? You know, red flags in the data about students, whether it's, you know, coming homeless or misbehaving and so forth. What are you especially looking at in terms of trends?
Unfortunately, all of these things are on the rise, which is unfortunate. And it really impacts students' ability to learn. Families are often experiencing crisis. We know that there's a substance abuse crisis in our state, and that's affecting the students. Students are coming to school with a lot of issues and so-called baggage that they can't check at the door. So we have to be able to, at the school and community level, to be able to support them when they come to school so we can help maximize their learning.
Well, and I like the way that you put it. They can't check those bags at the door and say, OK, I'm all done with this. And now I can come in and learn history. So, Amy, what do you do, though? A kid comes in with all that baggage. It is hard to focus on social studies when you haven't had a proper meal or you're wearing the same clothes or, you know, your mom and dad had a violent fight the night before and you carry that with you. What does a teacher do to help that kid, if not check the bag, at least set it aside so he or she can focus on learning?
Well, we first want to make sure that they have had a healthy breakfast. We want to make sure that if there are issues that they need to get off of their minds and get off their chests, that they have somebody to talk to. We'll connect them with a guidance counselor. We now, through this wonderful grant, Project Aware, have mental health caseworkers within the schools and therapists within the schools that we can connect them with. We are looking at programs to implement, like a responsive classroom and PBIS, which are great initiatives to have the students have a support system within their classroom to connect them with peers, to give them an outlet of having a morning meeting with their class and talking about, you know, what went on the night before. Not getting into details, but certainly just making sure that they know that they have people to talk to and people that care about them, because I think schools are looked at, hopefully still, as a safe place to be. So we hear a lot from the students when they are in our care because it's a safety place for them. So we just want to make sure that their basic needs are met. They've eaten, they've had enough rest. If we need to reach out to the parents and call them while school is going on to get more of an idea, we'll do that to look at the whole picture and teach as much as we can during that day.
Well, and I'm going to definitely ask you about that, how you work in education around all these other issues. But, you know, Casey, I was struck by your report and the other reports, including one by Natasha Haverty, how big a role just food plays in terms of what schools do today. Give us a little more there, please.
So, you know, obviously we talked about the food pantry at Berlin Middle School. My understanding is that there's also a food pantry in other schools in that district that have been started, at least as pilot programs, to fulfill students' needs at other grade levels. I know in Laconia they have, for I think at least several years, offered free dinner to students who participate in their after-school programs. And that's kind of a two-for-one in that they have the after-school program that gives students a safe space to be after school if maybe they can't go home right away, or, you know, they you know, have an activity to keep them engaged. And then they also get a nutritious meal. And I know in Laconia, they someone I talked to there said that they have a fair number of students who are getting literally every single meal for the day from the school
district.
Wow,
breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah, and some snacks even, too. They provide kind of healthy snacks throughout the day for some of the younger students. But yeah, and I mean, I think it you know, anyone knows that if you haven't eaten, even if you haven't eaten in a few hours and, you know, maybe you're late to lunch because you're working on something or whatever, that obviously impacts your attention, that impacts your mood, that impacts your ability to retain information and engage with those around you. So if you think about that in terms of a classroom setting where you really are supposed to be absorbing information and learning and growing, I don't think it's hard to see the connection there between why schools would recognize that as an impediment to student learning.
How is this affecting, Michelle, the school budgets? Are they able to provide lunch, which we hear about the struggles of the school lunch program in and of itself, to make healthy meals and pay for it? But then they have to add on breakfast and dinner. I just wonder if they have the financial capacity to do that.
Yeah, as you know, the financial capacity to be able to provide these services above and beyond basic education is a real struggle, and it's a real barrier across the whole state, across the whole country. But what's happening is we're piloting some frameworks right now, the Safe Schools, Healthy Students framework, to be able to partner with over 50 cross-agency partners across the state to be able to get creative about how we can fund these programs and services. There's a lot of blending and braiding of funding, so you really have to be creative. And our Office of Student Wellness is happy to be piloting a lot of that because we want to be able to lay out some examples and accessible supports to be able to do this in the future. So we are looking at sustainability. And although we have 6 pilot sites across the state, 6 school districts that receive funding from Safe Schools, Healthy Students, and Project Aware, which are the 2 SAMHSA grants that bring about $20 million into the state.
Those are federal grants.
Those are federal grants from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. We are planning a great deal of sustainability in terms of how we can support other school districts across the state.
So when you say sustainable, that's because federal grants eventually go away and you want to be able to continue to provide these services.
That's right. So by blending and braiding funding and being really creative about how we're funding these extra programs and services, building partnerships with the community mental health agencies, UNH Cooperative Extension, the Institute on Disability. I mean, there are over 100 partners across the state that are engaged in this right now. So we will be sharing in a toolkit a variety of ways to be able to fund these things and partner. But it really is about partnering.
So right now, the feds are saying, okay, schools, we realize this is expensive. Here's a little extra cash to help you out. But looking down the line, you're working with local agencies about how you can keep this going. Can you give me an example of blending and braiding? Like in one community, the YMCA said they would step up, or are there examples? Amy, you want to go ahead?
I sure can. So what we're doing in Berlin is we have partnered with our local mental health facility. So we have been able to, through our Project Aware grant, get caseworkers and therapists in the building. That theoretically took a caseworker and a therapist from the mental health facility, and they were able to fill those positions. So hopefully our local mental health facility would be able to continue to provide those services. We, like Casey was saying, we have an after-school program, which is another federal grant, but that's been along for a while, for the 21st Century Grant. We've partnered with dentists. We have a dental hygienist that comes into our school. We have partnered with our local PD, so we now have a school resource officer that's within the buildings. So definitely it takes a lot of coordination of services in the community. And I think everyone comes together because they have the same goal in mind, to protect the kids.
Is this the right role for schools, Casey? And I'm not asking you what you think, but what did you hear from people about whether this was the appropriate rule for schools?
I think that, you know, across the board, the people that I talked to, you know, obviously they want to walk a delicate line between not interfering too much with students' home lives where maybe it's not their place. But I think at the end of the day, if a kid shows up at your school and your job is to teach that kid, but that kid is not ready to learn, then what I'm hearing from all of the teachers and the principals and others that I talk to is that they don't really have a choice. They need to make sure that that student can focus and can engage, and that's why they feel like they have a stake in ensuring that student success by ensuring that their basic needs are met.
Well, we'll talk about that again after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, schools as social service providers. We're following up on our State of Democracy team's coverage this week on this issue, and let's hear from you. What are you seeing in your community with your own schools in terms of the expanded services that some schools are providing students? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. Amy Huter is with us, principal of Brown Elementary School in Berlin. Also, Michelle Myler, project coordinator of Safe Schools, Healthy Students at the State Department of Education. And Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter covering politics and policy. You can see Casey's reports and others on this issue of schools as social safety nets at nhpr.org. One more time, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, Casey first, please, let's return to this big question as to whether this is really what schools should be doing. Casey, you said people that you talked to, while they were concerned about not jumping into, you know, family personal business, felt like if they're supposed to teach kids, those kids have to be ready to learn. Go ahead.
Right. And I think that, you know, it's important to make the distinction here that this isn't really seen as just kind of like a side project or an extra thing that these schools are taking on. They're really viewing it as part of their educational mission to make sure that students are supported. Really, the phrase I heard over and over again is the whole child. So not just their academic kind of success, but, you know, they recognize that that's dependent upon a lot of other things that might be happening in their life, and they want to address that. And I think it's important also to point out that there's a lot of research in this area of the connection between a student's home life and the impact that that can have on his or her success, not only in K-12 schooling, but also then in their higher education and their career prospects. And so the teachers that I talked to really viewed this as a way to make sure that they're ensuring the long-term success of their students, but also the long-term success of their communities, because they recognize that if those kids are not taken care of now and they stay in the communities, then that might, you know, have an impact on the quality of life that they have in decades to come. So this is really kind of a long-term investment. And there's been some recent work out of Stanford University, their Center for Education Policy Analysis, that looked pretty extensively at the link between income levels and other socioeconomic factors and academic performance. And they found that across the country, that lower income communities in those schools, students tended to perform several grade levels below the national average academically, and higher income communities performed above average. And I think that that echoes a lot of other research in that area. And when I looked at the numbers for New Hampshire specifically, New Hampshire is known as a place where students' test scores tend to be above average generally. But even within our little slice of the country, if you plot those numbers out, then it mirrors what's happening on a national level, where the schools that are in lower income communities are behind and the schools that are in higher communities are generally ahead. So I think that teachers are viewing this as a way to try to level the playing field for kids across the board.
What do you think about this question, Amy? Again, as the principal of an elementary school, is this the right role for you guys?
I think it has to be. I think a child's social development is just as important as their academic development. So we need to be learning about a child's social emotional needs and how to meet them and how to educate them. We can't just suspend students for behaviors that we're seeing now because I fear what they're doing when they're not in school. So we are really having to come up with creative ways to keep them in school and to improve their behavior so that they don't get in trouble as often. They are more engaged in their learning, and they really want to be in school and they want to learn.
It's interesting. You know, I remember being in school when a kid misbehaved, they were just suspended or expelled. And but you're saying that's not really the way it's done now.
It still is done, definitely. There are times when it has to. But I think we are trying to think of many other ways to teach students about how to be respectful and how to stay in school and to keep teaching them as often as we can, because there are kids that might develop a pattern of misbehaving because they would rather be home and not be at school. And we certainly don't want to encourage that.
Well, and if a kid is homeless you're, you know, sending him home to be suspended and there's no home, I mean, that's complicated.
That's right.
Right there. What do you think about this, Michelle, too? I'd love your thoughts.
Well, we know that those youth in particular, the high-risk youth with the highest needs, need our support the most in a community or a school. And schools are positioned perfectly to be able to help grow the protective factors. Schools are protective factors. And when Amy mentioned resiliency before, above and beyond meeting the basic needs like clothing and food and health care, we really need to be able to support resiliency in youth. Because we're not going to be able to necessarily halt all of the trauma and the crisis that kids experience. I mean, we're hoping that that will improve down the road. There's a lot going on in our state to be able to address those issues. But we really need to be able to support the protective factors. You know, food and clothing are one of them, but also relationships. And in schools, you know, these days, many students, even as young as kindergarten, are showing up at school 7:30 for before school program, eating their breakfast, as we talked about, getting their snacks at school, having lunch, and maybe getting home on the late bus after having dinner at 6 o'clock at night. So the schools are really a supportive community, and we have just a perfect opportunity to be able to support them in all of the ways that we can. So it's not a question of should we, it's how do we.
Casey.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I got kind of a theme that was emerging when I talked to people was that this isn't necessarily viewed as a bad shift. It's, you know, in some ways, as was mentioned, the schools are positioned as kind of a literal hub for these students' lives. So it makes sense to try to bring in some of these services and be able to connect students with mental health counseling, other things that they might need but might maybe have trouble getting to transportation-wise or in other ways. But I think the issue that comes with that is that schools are worried about being able to support those things and sustain them because they're kind of all of this is coming at them at once, and they don't necessarily have the institutional structure built in place or the financial institutional structure built in place to be able to support that. So that's where some of the kind of anxiety around this arises.
So in other words, Casey, teachers are still there to teach.
Right.
If they have to do all this other management, when do they have time to, you know, focus on math lessons?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, what are your thoughts there, Amy?
I would love to jump in on that because I don't think our local budgets are supportive of all of these extra services right now. I think we have to depend on these federal grants, and thank goodness they're there. But I think local stakeholders really need to listen to the needs of the kids right now because I don't want to send students home when they're misbehaving and suspend them. So if I could have a behavior specialist in my school and a place for them to go that is teaching them how to be respectful, would love that. I know a lot of the, I have to say stakeholders, a lot of them are looking at our decreasing numbers of students.
You mean stakeholders, you mean taxpayers?
I mean taxpayers, yes, thank you. And they're looking at the numbers of students decreasing so that our number of funds should decrease as well. And that's not the case. Even though our numbers of students are decreasing, their needs are increasing. So the services that we have to provide them are costly and need to be supported by local funds. And I think that's where we need to, our voices need to become louder in that sense so that the local taxpayers can understand the services that we do need to provide in the schools, even if we do have a fewer number of students.
So why you are asking, for example, to, hire two more guidance counselors this year, because right. you need it. Okay, so here's the tough question, and I'm going to throw this to you, Michelle. What about parents? I mean, are the schools offering all these services? Is that, while helping the child, is that getting parents off the hook? I mean, shouldn't they be feeding their kids before they go to school? Are parents getting a free pass here from doing what they need to do?
So I'm really glad that you brought up the subject of the family, because when we talk about the whole child and creating programs and implementing services to be able to support them, we cannot isolate them from the family as well. So it's really about engaging families, and a large component of our framework for the Safe Schools, Healthy Students and Project Aware is engaging families. So we're doing this at the local level, supporting the schools and engaging families in many ways through family centers, for example, and inviting them to trainings and educational opportunities both in and out of the school. Engaging families is not easy. Families are busy.
No, you read my mind. I mean,
yeah.
It seems like there's lots of opportunity to engage with families, but it is hard to find the time. And maybe there's some resistance too. Don't tell me how to run my household.
There is a lot of that. A lot of parents don't, and guardians, grandparents are now raising grandchildren, all over the country. They have not had good educational experience for one reason or another. And so they're not coming to the school necessarily to attend these engagement opportunities. And then there are a lot of other barriers like transportation and work schedules. So we really are trying to get creative about how we're offering these and doing them outside of the school building, partnering with community mental health centers, agencies like the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Club. And again, it's about creativity and that cross-agency work.
Well, and in terms of eating before you leave, sometimes I have friends who live in the Berlin area and their kids get on the bus really early, so there may not be an opportunity to eat before you go. Some kids wake up and they don't want to eat anything. So go ahead,
so,
Michelle.
Also, it's not only about building the relationships with the students in the school, like I talked about before, is one of the protective factors, and building that resiliency, because not all students, as we know, have that stable, supportive adult in the home, and so they look to get that in the school. But we also need to be able to rethink the strategies and how we're trying to engage with families, because that's really about relationship building too. So in this multi-tiered systems of support in the school that we're piloting right now, we are inviting families to participate in planning services and treatment for their students that are really struggling and trying to build the relationships.
How successful has that been? Again, if a family already is struggling so much, how do they find the time or the wherewithal or the motivation to attend some program?
Well, sometimes you have to bring it to them. And I know, Berlin is looking into piloting the school to home visiting. So each child would get a visit from a professional in the school building. Sometimes it's about going to where the families are already. We really need to be able to be creative and engage coaches, bus drivers, anybody in the community who has interaction with the youth, because it really is a community model. We really are trying to build school communities because students are spending so much time there. So it's really going beyond those school walls and just being creative about how we're engaging families. It's not an easy one, and we're doing a lot of work at the state level to look at what the strategies are, what's working and what's not working.
Again, the phone number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Speaking of the role of the parents, an email has come in from Rob, who says it seems like such a natural fit for schools to provide 3 meals a day for children that are being neglected by parents at home. Is there also, Rob asks, a component where we go after those parents to right the ship and do their job providing for their kids? Rob says, without this, aren't we just enabling bad behavior? Why not just spend all of their money on drugs when someone else has taken on the responsibility of providing their children with all three meals? Rob, thank you for the email. And Amy, I want to hear from you on this, too. I know it's a tough one.
It is tough. And my response is always that we have to deal with what we're dealt with in the schools. So sometimes that connection with parents is hard, and that can't stop us from ultimately what our goal is, to educate the whole child. And like Michelle was saying, we just have to continue to be creative. There are some, you know, laws out there that parents need to be responsible for getting their children to school. There's a pretty strict truancy law that, you know, we can get truancy officers to help us with that, holding parents accountable. But again, ultimately, the accountability is always coming back to the schools and what we need to do from, you know, 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. and regardless of what is happening at home.
Again, the phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Rob, thank you for that one. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go to the phones. Ellen joins us from Goffstown. Hi, Ellen. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. I work at the community college in Concord, and I teach a course there. I'm interested in hearing from your panel what they think should be included as, you know, life experience or experiential assignment for pre-service teaching.
Could you say that again, Ellen? I think your phone is going out. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let me change my. Is this better?
Yeah. So you're teaching at the community college, and you're wondering.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering about what kind of experiential assignment would be effective, do they think would be effective for pre-service teachers who are going to be in the classroom in the next couple of years?
Okay, great question, and I'm glad she called. And Casey, we've talked a lot about, you know, kids and families, but how about teachers? I mean, this has to be affecting them too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's funny because I think if I lined up all of my interviews, I asked almost all of the teachers that I talked to, did you ever anticipate that your job would look like this?
Yeah,
and I think
prepared?
It would just be over and over again, not at all, not at all, not at all, not at all. So I think that, as the caller mentioned, there's really a lot of work to be done just in terms of teacher preparation. So, and I'm sure, you know, Amy could speak to this, but it's I think that, again, it gets back to emphasizing not just the curriculum, but also emphasizing how to engage with students in a crisis situation, how to recognize the kind of subtle signs that something might be off in a student's life, either when it comes to kind of their mental well-being, their physical well-being. There's a lot of little red flags that I think we've talked about in terms of the clothes that students are wearing, their demeanor, the way that they either kind of act out or tune out or shut down during class. So there's a lot of things that I think teachers have acquired, at least the ones that I talked to, just by kind of experience. But if there was a way to integrate that a little bit more into the teacher training, I think that that may hit what your caller was mentioning.
Yeah, Ellen, it's a great question. I'd love to hear from you, too, on this, Amy. You know, what might better prepare teachers for the additional challenges of today's classroom?
Great training that I have gone through and had some teachers and paraprofessionals go through is CPI training. And I know it sounds horrible, but it's crisis prevention intervention training. And the best part of it is how to de-escalate students when you start seeing their anxiety rate raise. They start getting angry. There are some great techniques of how to give them time and space and how to create maybe spaces within classrooms that kids can go to just to, you know, be alone and take a break.
Yeah. Well, and I'd love to ask you about that too, Michelle, and also how this affects the other kids who do come to school ready to learn. We should talk about them as well. Thank you so much for the question, Ellen. You can join us too at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, schools as social safety nets. NHPR's State of Democracy team this week is examining how schools are increasingly stepping in to help students struggling with many challenges at home. Give us a call. What do you see in your own community, in your own schools in terms of this, and what do you think? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And just before the break, Michelle, we were talking about the idea that, you know, this is tough for teachers. Our caller, Ellen, asked, are teachers really prepared to also become social service providers?
Yeah, we've had this conversation at the state level before, and I'm really glad it came up. We've spoken to professors in the past at how we can collaborate in the future at the Department of Ed, specifically out of the Office of Student Wellness, to be able to support what those additional courses and course material might be so that a teacher is going into this field and not feeling so overwhelmed by behaviors, not understanding how to necessarily meet the need, those types of needs, the social emotional needs of the students, so that they can teach the curriculum and the material. Some of the things that I suggest, and I would love if you reached out to our office too, the teacher who called in, but understanding trauma and how that affects behavior. There's a lot of movement in our state right now. We're working with a trauma expert. We'll be able to support schools in understanding trauma and how to respond. So it's really about creating trauma-informed schools. So that's a great subject area for teachers to have some understanding about. And then also, one of my suggestions is when students do their teaching assignments in a school to have some experience, even if it's just a few days, working in a school that has PBIS. So that's the Positive Behavior Interventions and Supports, because that is really a three-tiered model that is really helping schools to support the behavioral problems at all levels, at an universal level, so all students are receiving the same sort of proactive pre-teaching about behavior and expectations, and then that middle tier where students are getting who need just a little bit of extra are getting that little bit of extra support, and then the top tier kids who are the highest needs kids. But it is good to have an understanding of PBIS.
How much would you say, I'll throw this to you, Amy, that having to deal with all these challenges, you know, food and mental health and clothes and trauma at home. Sounds like teachers are sometimes overwhelmed by this. How much are they able to give the other kids what they need?
I think that is always on their mind. That's always a struggle. I see a lot of stress in teachers now. So I think administrators and parents and the communities really need to support our teachers as much as they can. And I get a lot of phone calls from parents when their child comes home and says that there was a child in their classroom that was loud or swearing. Or
worse, acting out, jumping around the room,
exactly.
Hitting other kids. I've heard these stories too.
And what are we doing about it? And I talk to them about the supports that that child has in place and that we do as much as we can so that it does not disrupt the learning of most of the students.
Real quick, Michelle. Yeah.
Oh, I just wanted to add quickly the framework that we're employing in piloting in these six school districts that receive the funding are rethinking the roles and job descriptions of guidance counselors, school psychologist, and creating those meaningful partnerships with the community mental health center so that we can alleviate a lot of this from the teacher so they can teach. But it really is about rethinking the way that we have created these systems of support, looking at the roles and trying to rethink. So even guidance counselors wouldn't be just putting out fires all day long. We're rethinking how we are offering services and support so that we're being more proactive.
Let's go back to our listeners, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. To Moultonboro, Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Paradoxically, I volunteer in two places. I volunteer in New Hampshire with the Got Lunch program in Meredith, which I think is a wonderful program that tries to support the summer months for kids that don't have access to nutrition. And in the winter months, I'm down in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm involved with the literacy program through Reading Partners. And I think I've encountered both issues at both locations. I am sure that I've met children who are having trouble reading because they're malnutrition. And I think I'm running into kids that probably are regressing in the summer months in New Hampshire because they don't get adequate nutrition. I think it's a wonderful program you're having today, and I think all these issues are very relevant.
Well, Bob, thank you for the call. And, you know, Casey, I know that it is always a concern for schools when school is out for the summer because some kids, as you said, get 3 meals a day there.
Right. And I think I'm not sure if this is the exact same program that the caller was mentioning, but there is a Got Lunch program in the Laconia area that has partnered. And this is another example of that kind of partnership between a school program and other kind of community players where they provide free lunches, I think, from local farms to students across the summer. And I'm looking at the numbers right now. And last year, the program served a total of something like 28,000 lunches to students over the summer, which is just a staggering number.
That is huge.
If you think about it. And they've served 120,000 lunches to date. So that really gives you a sense of the scope of the problem. And in Laconia, it should be mentioned, you know, as with a lot of the schools that we're talking about today, they have pretty higher than average rates of free and reduced lunch eligibility to the school year. So if you think about that, you know, in Laconia, Franklin, Berlin, we're looking at more than 40% of students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch. But that's only for maybe, you know, 3/4 of the year. So just think about what that means over the summer. So I think schools across the board are really trying to think of kind of, okay, what does this mean once school lets out?
Well, Bob, thank you for the call. Let's go to Corey in Manchester. Corky, excuse me. Go ahead, Corky, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
I've been listening to your program, and I think it's excellent. But my concern is that you're dealing with the problem well after it's established. It needs to be dealt with. There's no question about that. But I'm wondering, why aren't we teaching the students, while they're in the high school, parenting and child development, budgeting on a particular salary, time management, career options, consumer options, and things so that when they have their children, they can be successful.
So some of those life skills, Corky, you're talking about.
Exactly. We were teaching this in family and consumer science programs across the state, but it seems that I think a lot of that has been cut.
Yeah, we used to call it home economics, right, Corky?
Yes, years ago. But years ago, it was home ec, it was teaching sewing and cooking. But then it evolved to much, much more over the years. And then the program just seemed to be cut. And I just don't understand. Our children have to take weeks of lessons, and they have to pass a test in order to get their license to drive a car. But we don't give them any background except the family that they grow up in about raising children.
Well, Corky, thank you for calling in. What do you think, Amy?
Well, I know in Berlin we do still have programs like that. They start in middle school, and we do still have family consumer science. It was called home ec. They still learn how to sew. They still learn how to cook. I know in economics classes they're still learning how to balance checkbooks. So I don't think it has gone away. I think that, you know, what we're talking about today is really starting, it starts in kindergarten, of all of the mental health and behavior issues that we're seeing. So we're definitely not not focusing on what students need to be successful in life. And we certainly want them to be contributing citizens when they graduate from high school. And we want them to be college and career ready when we let go of them. So we try to prepare them as much as possible. So I think the focus of today's show is really, again, about their emotional stability and their behavior stability, and how do we meet those needs in order for them to be successful learners.
Go ahead, Michelle. Yeah,
I just wanted to add that you bring up a really good point, and I think as curriculum standards have increased, we're finding there just aren't enough minutes in the day. So those classes may be available to middle school and high schoolers, and I'm pretty sure, you know, like Amy said, they are across the state, but how much of that are they receiving? There aren't enough minutes in the day, so that it is one of the problems. And I know a lot of after-school programs are also offering these types of programs, but again, just like math or language arts, students really need to be able to have those basic needs and mental health needs met in order to be able to absorb that kind of information as well. So,
well, we talked earlier about how teachers could be better trained, some of the surprises that Casey mentioned when teachers come into the classroom and realize, oh my gosh, I have to deal with this. How concerned are you, Amy, about teacher retention? That, you know, people come into the classroom and they're excited and ready to teach history, but they really don't want to deal with all these other issues. You know, no knock against anybody, but that's not why they're in the business.
No, and I think nationwide we're seeing a dip in teacher retention. Luckily, in our community, we have a very veteran staff, and they are people who have either grown up in the community and are really invested in making a difference in the community. So they stay and they spend their entire career there. It really needs to be an understanding of teachers nowadays that it's not just about teaching. It really is about taking care of children, and they do need to be invested in their whole development. But I think it does need to be a concern of ours that we don't stress teachers out too much so that we can retain them for a long time.
Well, I'm a teacher. I'm not a social worker. Is it fair to ask teachers to be both, Michelle?
Well, I'll put a plug in for our office and the work we're doing with our two grants, because in the short few years that we've been implementing the Safe Schools, Healthy Students framework, we're already seeing really amazing outcomes in favor of all students. And what we're doing is we'll be scaling that up, and we'll be packaging it into a toolkit. We'll be offering support for schools across the state to be able to implement that. So hopefully we'll be seeing quite a change. We're breaking a lot of new ground with this model and having a lot of success with it, and have a lot of committed partners across the state that are invested in this work in the future. So hopefully we'll change that landscape, and we already are seeing that.
You know, I wonder, Casey, what you found as you did all this reporting about how much this issue is on policymakers' radar. And I'm also wondering which policymakers, if any, you know, local, state, federal, and so forth.
Well, I think it's definitely hard, I think, for local policymakers to ignore, particularly in the areas that are affected most by these issues. On the state level, I think it really depends. You know, I talked to a few lawmakers who actually used to work in the education profession. Senator Jeff Woodburn used to be a teacher in Coos County. Senator Nancy Stiles was a nutrition director, and I found out actually a bus driver at one point too, so has had experience with students on a lot of levels. And both of them said that, you know, they've seen these issues kind of growing in the time that they were in the school district. But they both also said that they do think that maybe it's it can be more resonant for people who represent parts of the state that are more affected by this, but it might get lost for others who maybe represent more affluent areas. So I think that it shows up in terms of how the education policy debates are shaped around the state house. We hear a lot of talk about testing. We hear a lot of talk about student privacy, other issues.
Teacher accountability.
Yeah. And there is a lot of talk, particularly this year, about, you know, the drug crisis and adding more education for that. But at the end of the day, there's not always this kind of understanding of the reality that schools are facing with all of these other social services and all of these other kind of challenges that students are bringing with them into school that are really falling on the backs of the schools to take care of. So I think that across the board, the teachers that I talked to said that they'd really like to see more attention paid to this, both in terms of general education policy, but also education funding, and recognizing that maybe when you're sitting down to calculate the formulas, there should be some way to take into account all of these extra services so that there's a more solid foundation for the schools to be able to provide this.
Let's take another call. This is John in Hillsboro. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi there. A point I would like the board or your panel to address is that I see these programs, as wonderful as they are, as somewhat creating more of the same problem that they're trying to fix. In that, for instance, with breakfast programs, the students, when they get to school, have to wait, even if they're not necessarily going to do breakfast, before they can learn. So why wouldn't a parent, you know, you talk about responsibility, but why wouldn't a parent say, fine, if my kid's going to sit there for a little bit before they can start being educated, why not have them? They might as well have breakfast there.
Sure. So some kids who don't even get the breakfast still take the early bus, and then they have to wait while the other kids have breakfast. Beyond the specifics of that, Amy, this gets back to Rob, our emailer earlier, who said, you know, are we enabling behavior by parents that that we wouldn't be enabling otherwise if we didn't have these programs here?
I don't think we are. Again, I think we have to deal with the issues that are in front of us, and the students that don't need it, they don't get it, and we offer them other services. So if they come in early for breakfast and they've already had it, then they get to go outside for recess, or they get to go to school, go to their classroom early. So I don't think we are enabling. I think we're just dealing with the problems that we are faced with.
And how much do you think this is on policymakers' radars? What do you think?
That's hard to say right now. I hope it's on all of their radars, but I'm seeing it with a lot more federal grants coming through, and I just hope it continues.
Well, all of you, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it. Casey McDermott, Amy Huter, and Michelle Myler, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. For more reporting on this topic, including video coverage from Berlin, go to our website, nhpr.org. And remember, the Exchange's conversations always continue online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org.